found the Digging Oak Island podcast, a podcaster's journey to discover the truth behind the Oak Island mystery. I'm Dave McBride. Thank you so much for downloading and listening. If you listen to or subscribe to the show on iTunes, I ask that you please leave us a 5-star rating there. Also, I'd like to invite you to join the show on Twitter and Facebook. You can follow us at Digging Oak Island. On today's podcast, we're going to discuss The Curse of Oak Island, Season 7, Episode 13, entitled Bromancing the Stone. Listeners will recall a time when I thought the showrunners were coming up with some good ideas for these episodes, at least for the titles. Well, those days are obviously long behind us now. Anyway, before we do that, we have a couple of new emails to answer. This is my favorite part of the show. First, we have a follow-up question from a listener named Steve. If you recall, Steve wrote us last week asking about property ownership on the island and about how really kind of all over the place the potential timeline is for whatever happened on Oak Island, and how it seems to be that each piece of new evidence they find indicates an entirely new and different century from the last one they found. This week, Steve asks us another great question. He writes, if they're really within 10 to 15 feet of the original money pit, it's going to be really interesting to see where that final borehole is dropped in relationship to 10X, C1, and the other big boreholes. That is, how close had they come previously? First of all, Steve, you are correct about how interesting the money pit project will be for the remainder of this season. The Laginas and their team have spent over 7 years now finding the original location of the money pit is really their primary objective here. And they at least appear to be closer now than at any other point during that 7-year period of the show's existence. 2 weeks ago, we had some real evidence in the form of hand-cut wood that certainly suggests that they might be in the right place, or at least pretty close. But how close is almost impossible to say, and that hand-cut wood is going to play a big role in this story. Especially in this episode, we're going to talk about more on that in a bit. What they've been trying to do this year is to attempt to locate other points on the historical map, other shafts dug in the area of the money pit, about which they have somewhat accurate historical information that might just allow them to sort of triangulate the position of the money pit. And it's always important to keep in mind that quote-unquote accurate historical information is a very, very relative term on Oak Island, and I mean, to say the least. I mean, the degree to which this is all just really educated guessing, even at this point, 200-plus years into the search, after decades of research and historical knowledge and all these guys who have dedicated their lives to this research, cannot really be exaggerated just to what degree. This really is just a lot of it just guessing. A lot of viewers seem to think this is all easy. But just trying to find out which treasure hunter did whatever they did over the years is in itself really a full-time gig for, I mean, look, 2 or 3 guys. Okay, let me put it like this. As I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, they found hunks of wood that looked hand-cut. And therefore, they concluded it most likely was part of the original money pit workings. Now, let's assume they're correct. And that is indeed where this wood came from, or at least where it originated from. Still, that by no means proves they're standing on top of the original spot where Daniel McGinnis, or John Smith, or Anthony Vaughan started digging back in 1795. In the years since its discovery, the money pit has seen a catastrophic collapse of most of all of its original workings. It's withstood a searcher from California with a love for huge bulldozers cratering out almost the entire area, and then just filling it all back in again. And on more than one occasion, it's had ocean water from inside the money pit itself burst out into other nearby shafts and other places. So, for instance, could that water have also taken some of the contents of the money pit, including this wood used to create the shaft, with it on its little journey to God knows where and dispersed it all throughout the area? Could those bulldozers move that wood to some other unknown underground location? Could the collapse have caused wood in the original shaft to disperse all throughout the area? You see where I'm going here, right? And besides these three things, that certainly could affect the integrity of any evidence here, so to speak. There have been many, many other such events. The money pit has been the victim of 200 years of digging, blasting, bulldozing, and flooding. Frankly, it's amazing the whole thing hasn't turned into one giant sinkhole as a result of all of this. Needless to say, finding old wood here is a great sign, especially some of the information we're going to have later, and it is a fascinating clue. But it doesn't necessarily mean that they are standing in the exact right spot. So yes, I will be fascinated to see how any such project this season relates to other places where they already dug in this area that we call the Money Pit. The show has been oddly cagey about that so far, about where exactly they are. You mentioned one already, borehole C1, but there have been others in the Money Pit area, other very educated guesses, which all started out with great hopes, you know, only to come up empty in the end. C1 was the one Charles Barkhouse was certain was the best place on the island to dig for treasure. There was Gal 1, was named after Rick and Marty's parents, at equal levels of optimism, only to bring up more questions than answers. It seems we've had one or two such giant boreholes in each of the last few seasons of the show. Is this one going to be any different than all the rest? Well, maybe, but also maybe not. The show, the narrator, the cast, they're all filled with hope. And they tend to fill us with that hope too. But you got to keep in mind, this is a 200-year-long frustration for everyone who has tried. Just keep that in mind before you get your hopes up with this particular one. Steve, you also mentioned 10X, which I didn't include in that last sentence there or that last paragraph there, because 10X, perhaps the most famous and successful project in all of Dan Blankenship's career of hunting on Oak Island, is not really located in what I would call the Money Pit area. It's just to the east of the Money Pit, kind of between there and Smith's Cove. Dan found the spot by actually using dowsing or divining rods, so he wasn't really looking specifically for the Money Pit while doing that. But that's an amazing story for another podcast. We'll get to that down the road. Thanks for the email, Steve, and thank you for listening and for following up with your last email. We have another question from a listener named Mike. He asks, I started listening to your podcast. I really enjoy it. Thank you very much, Mike. The question I have is, does the show jump around during the entire season or does it go chronological? The reason I ask is the last episode were during the last episodes were during Hurricane Dorian. We toured the island the weekend after and the cofferdam was already being taken out. The picture is from that day we took the Salty Dog tour. Okay, that's a great question, Mike, and one I see asked a lot on social media. This is a tough one to answer, and I really do have to preface this by saying that all I can do here is something of an educated guess from somebody who watches this a lot and watches each show multiple times. But I think if you look closely at the show, you can probably see how it does indeed jump around, at least to some degree. The producers would like you to think that this is there's like about a week between episodes, you know. Like this is all in real time, essentially, but just take a look at, you know, sometimes all you gotta do is take a look at what the guys are wearing and you could see how it appears, you know, massive temperature shifts have taken place in the course of that 1 week or even within an episode from, you know, one scene to the next. And don't look at Billy Gerhardt because that guy wears shorts year round, no matter what the weather is, which is amazing for a guy in Nova Scotia, but that's neither here nor there. Also, look at the surrounding vegetation you can see in the background in some of these shots, too. There you can find a lot of evidence of this sort of time jumping, you know. But I totally understand why this takes place. It's important to say that. The producers of this show often sacrifice things like accurate timelines for the sake of a good narrative and really to make it easier to follow the program. Nearly every quote-unquote reality show does this, and you could see why a lot of the times. Just in the Curse of Oak Island terms, take an item that's been found, you know, pulled out by Gary Drayton or whoever, and it needs to undergo some sort of testing or dating. Who knows how long it really takes to get these things through university lab or set up a meeting with an expert or have it sent off to somebody in Germany who can take the time to look at it and study it. If they adhered strictly to something of a chronological editing plan, you could see how some viewers might find it confusing and distracting. I'm forever hearing people complain about how much the show kind of repeats itself. Imagine how much more often they would have to do that under this strictly chronological presentation. As viewers, we are all well aware of how many different storylines and subplots emerge within a single season. And I just can't blame the producers for trying to make it just a bit easier to follow, especially for people who might not watch as religiously as we all do. Sure, they are manipulating things to their advantage. I understand that. But sometimes that manipulation might be to the viewer's advantage as well. Just keep that in mind. Honestly, I really try not to get too distracted by that. But you can be sure the show does indeed jump around, to use your phrase. And honestly, your photo is the best evidence we can possibly ask for with this. Listeners, other than our questioner here, as we speak, I'll be posting this photo that Mike sent me on our Facebook and Twitter pages. You can go take a look for it yourself. It's really kind of cool. By the way, thank you so much for that, Mike. Thank you so much for sending along that photo. If you have any others you'd like me to post on our Facebook or Twitter pages, Mike, feel free to send them along. Now, before we move on to the episode review for this week, let's not forget this little last part of Mike's question. What is a salty dog tour, you might want to know? Well, it's a guided boat tour around Oak Island where passengers can go, quote, on an adventure as we explore the mysteries of Oak Island and the magic of the greater Mahone Bay area. And, quote, take a narrated trip by sea to view the key sights of the island as seen on the History Channel show The Curse of Oak Island. Now, if that doesn't sound awesome enough on its own, let me add this little detail. Y'all know who Tony Sampson is. He's the diver we've seen many times on the show. He runs Salty Dog Tours and is the captain on many of these tours. Certainly a bucket list item for many an Oak Island fan, myself included. Tours run from about late June, I think, or I think maybe like April-ish, actually, to early November or so. They leave out of the Oak Island Marina, which is part of the Oak Island Resort and Conference Center, which is located on the wonderfully named Treasure Drive in Western Shore, Nova Scotia. It's on the mainland, just across the causeway, and just a bit north of the Oak Island itself. All of these things are on my bucket list. If only I actually made money off this podcast, I might be able to afford to go up there. Thanks again, Mike and Steve, for your emails and great questions. Please, please, please keep them coming in. Answering these is such great fun for me. If you would like to email me your thoughts or your questions as well for us to discuss on a future show, you can do so. DiggingOakIsland@gmail.com. So it's time for us to discuss Season 7, Episode 13 of The Curse of Oak Island, entitled Bromancing the Stone. Ugh, jeez. Anyway, despite the god-awful title, it was a pretty good hour of television, if I'm honest. Let me begin here with the return to the show of the famed 90-foot stone. If you don't recall, back in Episode 7, Rick Lagina told an unbelievable story of how some local guy named Kevin Rideout approached him at Dan Blankenship's funeral, telling him how 40 years ago, while he was visiting a museum in Dartmouth, Nova Scotia, it's a little town just across the bay from Halifax, a museum called the Evergreen House, and it's referred to on this episode as the Dartmouth Heritage Museum. While Rideout was on a tour of the grounds, apparently one of the museum workers pointed out a window down to a stone lying in the grass below. The tour guide told Rideout, and I presume anyone else there with him, that it was a stone from Oak Island brought to the museum for safekeeping. In that same episode, we also learned from current museum curator Terry Island that the staff has no records of any such stone ever arriving from Oak Island or really ever even being there. Just try and wrap your mind around that one for a second. Now, if you'd like to learn the full story here about the stone and why it might be at this house, go back and have a listen to the podcast I did on Episode 7. From the episode was called Things That Go Bump Out. I should have seen these bad names coming. And you'll see right there in that episode that there is a somewhat compelling, if not altogether concrete, connection between the history of the stone and the owner of this house at the time it apparently was moved there. But let me just give you some of the bullet points to catch up here a little bit. The house was owned by a woman named Dr. Helen Creighton. She was known throughout Canada as the Canada's first lady of folklore, in quotes, and was also the cousin of a man named Augustus Oliver Creighton, who was not only a treasure hunter on Oak Island, but also owned the famous bookbindery, which was essentially the last documented place the stone was ever really seen. Okay, So I've left out a lot, but now you're pretty much up to speed. There's a lot more to the 90-foot stone story, obviously. But like I said, go back and have a listen to that podcast I did in episode 7. And also on the podcast I released just after that, which I think it was on January 2nd, that was dedicated entirely to the legend of the 90-foot stone. Now, even though I'm dubious at best about what we now call the history of the stone, the 90-foot stone in air quotes, especially about this story from Kevin Rideout. In fact, I think if you listen back to my episode 7 podcast, I called it something like a fish story. But even back then, I felt there was enough of a connection in all this, enough of a connection to sort of important historical figures involved in Oak Island to at least warrant some kind of investigation, for no other reason than to just cross it off the list. And by investigation, I don't necessarily mean a backhoe, but I'll get to that in a second. But that's what we have here in this week's episode. The Laginas have granted permission by the government to dig in the area where this stone was last seen by Mr. Rideout, and apparently only Mr. Rideout, which I find very peculiar if you haven't gleaned that yet. I mean, really, this tour guide never told this story to anyone else? With the amazing popularity of Oak Island throughout Nova Scotia, wouldn't you think this would be in the script for every tour? Even on the brochure? But apparently it was not. It's very strange. Rick Lagina is there with Doug Kroll, archaeologist Laird Niven, and heavy equipment operator Billy Gerhardt to start digging. Billy is at the helm of this kind of small excavator, and he starts pulling up dirt and an absolutely enormous amount of big rocks. Am I the only one that noticed the ground there is basically nothing but a huge pile of boulders? Nobody said anything about that. Needless to say, within this huge mess of rocks, they predictably don't find the famous 90-foot stone and instead have basically torn the ground up at this museum for essentially nothing. Now listen, I know they can put it all back nicely and make it look even better than before they started, but it's hard for me not to think they should have done maybe just a bit more research on this theory before coming in with implements of destruction. Maybe they could have found another source to at least verify this story in some way before going on what was essentially, in hindsight, a fool's errand here. Now, I don't normally criticize the team for following a lead, but this lead did seem flimsy at best, as flimsy as any I've ever really seen on the show. You would think the Laginas and the showrunners must be absolutely flooded with ideas, potential leads and theories from crackpots the world over. And probably more and more every day as the show's popularity increases. They can't follow them all, and frankly have a hard time seeing what in this particular lead compelled them to invest the time and effort they dedicated here. Sure, maybe it was only a couple of days worth of work and some time filing paperwork and paying for permits and such, but the fact is, summers on Nova Scotia are short. I can't imagine they have many spare days, anyway. At least we know another location where the 90-foot stone isn't. For whatever that's worth. Let me take a minute here and mention another scene I found a little strange, and that's the war room scene from early on in the episode. If you recall, last week, Rick Lagina and Doug Kroll traveled to the Fortress of Louisbourg, since the history of the fortress seems to line up with some of the new dating information the team gathered off wood unearthed recently and a couple of episodes before in Smith's Cove. Again, if you're not 100% familiar with what I'm referring to, I'd suggest you go back and listen to my last podcast, Forever Plugging My Old Shows, which covered both episodes 11 and 12. It's all in there. You get the whole story. The date the team got from the wood in Smith's Cove was 1741, a time period where the fortress at Louisbourg was in its heyday. In fact, I think Doug Kroll might have used that same expression last week. Louisbourg is a few hundred miles away from Oak Island on Cape Breton Island, which is just to the northeast of Nova Scotia. It's an incredible fortress built by the French in the 18th century, one of the biggest in the world when it was built. After watching the footage from Louisbourg last week, I was really stunned that the showrunners felt it needed a follow-up of any kind in this week's episode. I mean, let me say this. I love these trips when the team goes out beyond Oak Island and brings in some of the other locations in Nova Scotia, often connected to the mystery over the years by researchers and theorists, and show up in a lot of these books that you read. But, and I said this last week, there really wasn't anything they found at Louisbourg in that last episode that really amounted to anything more than, you know, what was some great footage and useful background information about this incredible fortress, which has figured into potential theories for the Oak Island mystery, you know, for decades and decades. It certainly didn't need the entire team to get together and look at photos of, you know, a rather unremarkable 18th century above ground water drainage system. The fact is, no matter how many times the narrator tries and tries to equate these features seen at the fortress at Lewisburg with Oak Island, no matter how many different ways he rephrases it, the connections remain, you know, nebulous at best, I think. Yes, there is a drainage system. Yes, there is a pile of rocks. But if we accept the theory that this wooden Smith's Cove is from a date when the mystery began, then why would we be stunned or even interested in other places built during the same time period looking slightly similar? Here's what I mean. I don't think I phrased that very well. And maybe I'm totally off base here, but you can look at houses built throughout the northeastern United States that were built, you know, around the colonial period. And you'll find an amazing amount of similarities in those houses in all sorts of areas. Does that mean they're all designed and built by the same builders? Of course not. So while you might agree the things shown from Lewisburg look similar, I guess, to things found in Oak Island, and I don't really agree, but that's neither here nor there, the types of things being shown and the types of similarities is evidence of nothing more than perhaps they were built in roughly the same century. Does that really merit the precious airtime of a war room scene filled with lots of nodding and pontificating? I'm just not so sure it does. But enough with the negativity. Let's move on to the swamp. The episode begins with Rick Lagina and Tom Nolan looking over the swamp and the narrator refers to as the paved stone walkway that they discovered earlier this season. It appears the area has been cleared a bit more since we last left, and it's even a bit drier. I have to admit, I have a hard time kind of visualizing this thing, like from the television footage here, and I wouldn't be surprised if other viewers kind of feel the same way in this regard. The size is really hard for me to gauge, and the remaining dirt that kind of sits on top of these stones just makes it appear a lot less impressive within these quick shots we get during these scenes. I mean, if you take that overhead shot where you see Rick and Tom walking down the planks, you know, heading towards the paved area, it really makes the whole area look, you know, like nothing really all that unusual. But like I said, I think that's just a product of not being there firsthand to see it. You can certainly see what appears to be an even layer of stones lying on top of the dirt. Tom notices they all seem to be the same kind of stones, which Rick refers to as gray wacky. Gray wacky is a fun term for like just a certain type of sandstone. You can really find these gray wacky stones anywhere. They've been used for building stuff for centuries. There's nothing really unusual there, but it's a fun name, gray wacky. And while I might have a hard time visualizing the scope of this discovery, it has to be said Rick and Tom are very impressed by what they've uncovered here. So is the narrator, who calls it, quote, their biggest breakthrough yet. Well, perhaps their biggest breakthrough yet, end quote. The two guys use terms like so level and so uniform to describe what they're seeing. Nolan says, quote, it's like you're standing on a paved road in the middle of a bog. Again, that's something I really think you need to be there firsthand to get really what he means. Now, as I'm sure you know, Tom's father, Fred Nolan, spent a huge bulk of his decade searching on Oak Island, investigating the area of the swamp. And as they continue to uncover this paved walkway, we begin to discover the size and scope of it. It does kind of seem a little bit surprising to me that Fred would not have found even a trace of it at some point, seeing as he spent many an hour wading around and poking around in that swamp. But Tom says his father, quote, never had the ability to do this to the swamp, end quote. So perhaps we really are on the verge of a true Oak Island breakthrough here, and that is very exciting. As I mentioned last week, three of the show's resident experts were also very impressed by this find. And one of the best suited to examine it, Dr. Ian Spooter of Acadia University, Nova Scotia, the swamp doctor, as I like to call him, is back to get a better look at the area. And he is convinced that this was not done by some natural glacial movement or some any other sort of natural thing like that that would move rocks around, but it was instead manipulated by man. And he thinks that the area he's called a, quote, paved stone platform, end quote, is old. In fact, he says, quote, it's old, It's old. All in a row. Not a lot of wiggle room there, I think. What he does next is show Rick this stick, this little twig. I mean, it's not a twig, but this big stick that he found jammed in between two of the rocks. It's his opinion that there's no natural way the stick would have ended up there, meaning if these rocks are here for glacial reasons, well, when the glacier was there, there would be no trees. So the only way that it would be put there would be during the process by which man or whoever did this laid down the stone. So if we can date this stick, then essentially we are dating, at least given a ballpark dating of the stone area and when it was put there at the same time. It's a fascinating theory, and I wouldn't for a second dispute or debate the opinion of someone whose life has been dedicated to studying just such an area as this Oak Island swamp. You can bet your bottom dollar we will get that stick dated before the end of this season. It's very exciting stuff. It really is. Later, Billy Gerhard is continuing his digging around the swamp, basically looking to uncover the extent of this paved area. He's joined by Gary Drayton and Jack Begley, who plan on metal detecting in the spoils. They say that word a lot, spoils. It's really just a fun word for the piles of dirt, sort of the extra dirt pulled out that the excavator pulls out when they're trying to dig down for something else. I would imagine these spoils must smell absolutely lovely. So while Billy digs, Gary's detecting. They start to find what seems to be more of this paved area in the process of Billy digging here. It appears to extend further than they even originally thought, really adding to the mystery here. I mean, we have an expert that is convinced this is man-made. And like I've said in the past, it's absolutely possible this area was once not covered in water, once dry ground. In fact, it seems likely that was the case, all things considered. But even with that in mind, as we uncover more and more of this structure, or whatever it is, the scope of how big a project this really was to build becomes even larger, and therefore even more baffling. Later in the show, Gary and Jack uncover an old pickaxe and a spade shovel, at least the head of it, in the area around what they call the eye of the swamp, the small oval-shaped area just above the triangle shape that makes up, you know, most of the swamp. It seems to make all the sense in the world to find such tools near and around an area where it would appear, from what they're finding here, a lot of digging and a lot of work kind of took place. I would imagine these tools will be dated in a future episode, so we'll put them aside until that happens and not really discuss them too much until we get a little bit more information on that. Now, I don't know about you, but I, for one, am loving this stuff in the swamp now. It reminds me of the work done in Smith's Cove last year. I know many, many viewers want to see them uncover a huge pirate treasure chest or find the Ark of the Covenant in an Indiana Jones-style underground chamber. And I know many of those same viewers are often frustrated by these episodes, and many, many episodes spent on things like this paved platform area. But not me. I love this stuff. Now, I don't normally talk a lot about, the future episode or spoilers or even the preview scenes because, you know, those things can be awful and misleading. But I just, with this swamp thing in mind and how excited I am about it, I just want to read you the official History Channel description of what the next episode, which is not for 2 weeks, folks, if you didn't know that, there won't be an episode next week. I'll discuss that at the end of the show. Here's what the next episode, what they're calling 15, but should be 14, kind of strange. New hard evidence suggests that Fred Nolan's theory that a ship was buried in the swamp centuries ago may be true. I mean, this is getting more and more exciting. So let us finish today's podcast off over at the Money Pit area. We talked a little bit about this already in the email section, but just to review, we are where we are here, just trying to locate the original location of the Money Pit. It's been lost for decades, almost a century. The team thinks they are at a point closer than ever in their time at achieving that goal. And now they're bringing up core drilling samples. These are basically these small cylinders of earth you see collected while drilling a hole in the ground. They bring them up in these little plastic bags, these sort of 10-foot sections. They're looking to see if they can find evidence that they are indeed in the right place before launching a much larger scale and much more expensive digging project. We've seen them employ this method of using core drilling samples many, many times for basically the length of the entire show. There was a bit of fleeting hope there for a moment when the guys, when the one guy running the drilling itself thought he might have encountered a void at around 110 feet or so. You can hear him talk about how it just sort of dropped down. It's right at this depth, right around this 100 to 110 feet level, where the first couple of treasure hunting organizations digging down into the money pit, many of those treasure hunting organizations, including some or all of the original three discoverers of the money pit, it's really at this depth where those guys were convinced the treasure chests would be found. And it was below 120 feet or so where things like parchment, pieces of gold chain, and all that kind of stuff that was found in the money pit, that's where it actually was found, just below this level. So that's why this depth we're talking about here is so critical to the search. But unfortunately, it ends up being what geologist Tony Matheson calls virgin ground, meaning essentially that this can't be the money pit, since we know with certainty that that area in the money pit has already been disturbed at this depth, or at least I guess we hope it was. But that's just one sample that they pull up here with a lot more to come. So work around the money pit ends for the episode. The team just sort of moves this drill over a few feet, tries again to find what they're looking for. So even though today's work at the money pit doesn't really produce anything all that exciting, previous work done in this very same area certainly does. And in the final scene of this episode, we have our second war room meeting, this time with Craig Tester, who has carbon dating test results from a piece of wood taken out of the money pit a couple of weeks back. Let's review. A few weeks ago, the team felt they had found shaft 2, a searcher shaft connected via a tunnel, horizontal tunnel, to within a foot or two of the money pit. They followed this possible tunnel with their core drilling in the direction of the money pit, and the wood we are looking at here comes from one of the core samples brought up during that particular project. And in fact, it was found a few feet deeper than where they thought the tunnel might have been. When discovered, the team was convinced the wood was axe cut and looked much older, or at least much different from previous wood found in this same area. So they sent this piece of wood out for carbon dating, or C14 dating, I think, as they refer to it here. It comes back with an astounding date range of 1626 to 1680. Let me just remind you why that date is so incredible. The money pit was discovered in 1795. The island was not even officially surveyed and divided into plots of land to be sold off until, I think, the 1760s. So while certainly European settlers, military personnel, and I guess pirates and absolutely local First Nations people were living and traveling throughout this area during the years between 1626 and 1680, why in God's name would they be hand-cutting wood and then burying it 100 feet deep on what had to be at that point an uninhabited land? I talk a lot about whether or not it was inhabited in 1795. I can't say that there were European settlers or anybody like that at this time frame. It just seems completely impossible. Try as a skeptic might, there is no good or logical answer for this one in my mind. This is big, really big. This is not wood from Gilbert Hedden or a James Pitblotto or even from Franklin Delano Roosevelt for that matter. And it wasn't put there by a former property owner working his land or maybe trying to dig a well or something like that. It's a mystery. Plain and simple, a mystery. Now, carbon dating is not nearly as accurate as the dendrochronology testing we have seen performed on other pieces of wood in recent years on the show. That process usually comes up with a single year with a near 100% certainty of the accuracy of that year. Carbon dating is a lot less exact. But if the date of whatever work this wood was part of actually falls into this range, and literally at any point in this 54-year range, then this, folks, is nothing short of a game changer. And the skeptics are going to need to get rather creative in trying to write this one off. Like I said before about the new discoveries in the swamp, this is the stuff I absolutely love. This is why I watch this show. I can't tell you how many people I saw on social media complaining about how boring this episode was, how they wasted another hour of television without finding any treasure, no Ark of the Covenant. I mean, give me a break. Let me say it like this. If the discovery of a huge man-made platform underground in a swamp and the discovery of a piece of wood pulled out from 100 feet deep that dates back to more than a century before anyone was here, if those kind of things don't excite you, honestly, maybe the Oak Island mystery and this television show and this podcast just isn't for you. So that's going to do it for this episode of Digging Oak Island. Like I mentioned before, there is not a new episode of the Curse of Oak Island television show next week. The History Channel is airing a three-part documentary on George Washington, which is looks really good. So I'll be watching that. No reason to discuss that here on the Digging Oak Island podcast, however. If you follow my Facebook or Twitter page, you probably would have known by now that the reason why this show came out a little later in the week than I usually like to do it, I usually like to have it up by Friday morning and not Friday night or Saturday morning. I had a little bit of a computer meltdown, which I seem to have fixed, but I might need a week off next week to try to get this all right and get this all back in order for future episodes. So if you don't see a episode next week, that is why. I might do something, maybe something different, something special. We'll see. So just keep subscribed to that, and if one pops up in your feed, there you go. If not, don't be surprised if I don't see it till the following week when it really comes back with a vengeance. In fact, Drilling Down is going to, the pregame show is going to happen at 8 o'clock on February 25th, and it's starring William Shatner. History Channel fans will know that William Shatner is putting out sort of a new one of these unexplained, I think it's called the Unexplained show. So that's pretty exciting to see Captain Kirk come to Oak Island. And then, of course, we already mentioned the episode that's going to take place at 9 o'clock at its normal time. But that's, again, not until February 25th. Thanks again for listening to the Digging Oak Island podcast. I hope you do enjoy it. If you do, I ask that you please rate and review us on iTunes or wherever you listen and can rate us. My heartfelt thanks to everyone who has done so already. Thank you so much for taking the time to do that. And thank you so much for the kind words. If you know anybody interested in the Oak Island mystery, please kind of share this podcast with them as well. The more, the merrier. Like I mentioned, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. We are at Digging Oak Island. And don't forget, if you have any questions or comments you want to send directly to me, you can do so via email at diggingoakisland@gmail.com. Please be aware that if you do email me, it can be discussed on the show. If you don't want it discussed on the show, just make a note of that specifically for me, and I'll just answer it via email. So until we speak again, I'm Dave McBride. Thank you for listening to Digging Oak Island.